Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of our program, MATS, the Martial Arts Talk Show. My name is Danny Venner. Today is June 2nd, 2022, a minute after 7 o'clock in the evening. Yes, you can call in tonight at 563-999-3090. Let me give you that number again. Area code 563-999-3090. All right. Tonight, we always start off our program by giving thanks to our founder, Shimabuku Tatsuo Sensei, his first generation students, and all of their black belts that have built this wonderful foundation that we're all standing on today. So thank you. Thank you for doing the work. Tonight, we have a guest on the program that has a wonderful story to tell in both martial arts and in life. So let's bring him onto the program. Sensei Keith Webb, welcome, sir. Welcome to our program, and we're so excited to talk to you. So,
well, thank you for having me this evening. I appreciate it.
Awesome. We're looking at maybe getting in the car, taking a drive back to when you started in martial arts. How did you get started in martial arts?
Well, that story goes back a bit further than my time in Ishinryu. We have to go back to 1984 to start that story. In 1984, I was a freshman in high school, and you know, I had always been a small kid. I was always the skinny, you know, kind of geeky guy that. You know, a lot of people found it easy to pick on and bully. And I reached a point probably in 1983, 84 in that area where I was pretty much just kind of tired of taking it. I lived out in the middle of nowhere. I lived up in northeastern North Carolina at the time in a place called Currituck County, which was at the time very rural. There wasn't a whole lot of anything out there as far as martial arts instruction. The closest place we could go for martial arts was in Elizabeth City, which was about 20 miles away. And Tola Lewis was teaching out there in the Elizabeth City area at the time. And my parents couldn't afford to send me for lessons. And so I basically started my martial arts journey by reading all of the books I could get my hands on, mimicking what I saw them doing in those books and things of the sort. And I did that for a few years, I suppose. I started training my own kogoro in the same way. I went out in my father's workshop, and I made some nunchucks, and I made some tonfa, and I carried around a cane and a staff, and I just used them all the time and became, at the time, without an instructor, I consider myself to have been fairly proficient in a lot of those things. Now, did I know martial arts? Not really. Could I mimic martial arts? Yes, but that was kind of the start of my martial arts journey. And in 1987, I graduated from high school, and I went to East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. And I met up with some folks there who were training in the Goju Shorin style of karate. That was founded by Soke Bill McDonald, who had a very vast background in his training experience. And he had a school there in Greenville, and he had a club on ECU's campus. And I joined up with that martial arts club, and here I am a while later, 30-something years, 35 years later, and I'm still friends with some of the people. Tim Garris, I still esteem as a very close friend and martial arts brother who trains. He still teaches in Greenville, as a matter of fact, and he's a Sandan in Goju Shorin. I got to work out with some really fine individuals. Curtis Buzzsaw Jackson, who is a North American kickboxing champion. I trained with the Ormsby Sensei out there in Greenville. Tony Googe, who still runs a dojo now down in South Carolina. So Dale Land, another fine martial artist. I just had all of these excellent martial artists that I spent several years training with, and graduated from school in 91, and then went back for graduate school and trained some more. But once I graduated and got out of school, got married, started having children, you know, the family thing kind of took precedence. I didn't have a dojo that I would train at. I was living in Farmville at the time, and I was living out in the middle of nowhere in Greene County, and then out in Farmville for a while here in North Carolina, and very, very, very rural places. So I didn't have anywhere to train, but martial arts was always in my head, as it had been for the previous, you know, 10 years at this point in time. So a lot of time passed where I wasn't formally training, and then I moved to Tarboro, and we lived here in Tarboro for, I guess 4 or 5 years, and we were raising our children, and our younger boy, Silas, he had some, you know, extra energy, let's say that. He had a lot of extra energy that we needed to see if we could help him burn off a bit. And, you know, we considered our options, and I saw that that Cunningham Sensei had a dojo here in Tarboro. And I was like, hey, here's an idea. We could sign Silas up for karate, and that'll help him burn off some of the energy. It'll give him some, you know, a focal point for some of his needs, if you will. And, you know, what do you think about that? And I asked my wife about it. She said, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. And I asked Silas about it. I wanted his input on it. He was, I think, 8 at the time. And he said, okay, you know, I'll try it. So we trotted Silas down to Sensei's dojo, and he went and trained at the time one day a week on Saturday mornings. And so Alice and I would get up and drive Silas out to the dojo every Saturday. And Silas would get out there on the mat, and he would do his thing, and he loved it. He just absolutely embraced you know, the whole karate lifestyle, and he was kind of the man, if you will. I guess probably after about, let's see, Silas started in November of 2008, and probably around April or May of 2009, my wife and I were sitting in the dojo and watching Silas, and my wife leans over to me. You know, I've had the yen the entire time, of course. I've been kind of watching Silas, wishing that I could be out there with him. But Alice leans over to me sometime in mid-2009, and she goes, you know what? I'd really like to try this. And I was like, sold. We're signing up tomorrow. So we talked to Sensei after Silas's class was done, and she and I and our older boy, Daniel, all started our Ishinru journey probably just a couple of weeks after that. And, you know, we've been training with Cunningham Sensei since. We have always kind of let our children kind of their own course, if you will. We didn't, you know, drag any of our children into the dojo. When our older daughter would come with us to the dojo, she would literally just sit back in a corner and she'd read books the whole time she was there. She'd hardly ever pay attention to what was going on the floor. Our younger daughter was really not paying too much attention to it at the time, but she kind of knew that we were always in the dojo doing karate. So about the time Emma, our younger daughter, got to be 6 years old, she said, "I want to start taking karate." So we took her out and geed her up and put her on the mat, and she started training with the youth classes out there. And so now we had Silas and my wife and I and my older son and my younger daughter all training. My older daughter was still just Hannah. She was sitting in the corner of the dojo reading books, as she always did. And about 2 years into the journey, we started, Sensei Cunningham and some of his instructors started a women's self-defense class that eventually morphed into a women's only karate class. And at that time, Hannah was like, "I want to do the women's class." So Hannah signed up for the women's class. So we started bringing her to the Tuesday night women's class. We would train Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And, you know, we would be the dojo family, if you will. Eventually, we all ended up in the same class, in the adult class. So six members of the Webb family all training and doing, you know, doing the thing. And we probably did that for several years until Daniel graduated from school and worked in town for a little bit before he joined the military and was off the basic training. By the time all was said and done, it's not all said and done. I can't really say that. By the time we reached the point where Daniel picked up and went to the military, we had five full-fledged black belts. Emma was a junior black belt. She was the youngest junior black belt ever promoted by Sensei in the dojo. She started age six. She was promoted to Shodan Ho at age 12. She spent 4 years at Shodan Ho and then trained, she tested for full Shodan. So Emma is a Shodan. Hannah is a Nidan. Silas is a Shodan, my younger son. He is currently serving in the military with the 82nd Airborne Division in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Daniel is a Nidan. I'm a Yandan, and Alice recently tested and was awarded the rank of Yandan just a couple of weeks ago. So there you have the journey.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. So, you know, I mean, just think of that for a second, folks. Family who started out trying to get their child to burn off some steam, and they find this place to go to, and who do they find? Kim Cunningham. All right. Now, for those of us who know him, we don't have to say anything because we know who he is. But to find that person, and now the whole family get involved with that person and the dojo, all the people that come there, and it's like an extended family. So again, extraordinary. What a journey. Now, you said something at the beginning about when you started, you go in Dad's workshop and you'll make some weapons. Could we talk a little bit about that? Because that really interests me, because now you said something about nunchucks, maybe some other weapons that you made. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that's really interesting.
Okay, sure. So, of course, you know, the mid-80s, early mid-80s were kind of like the heyday for martial arts films. Yeah, we had that inception point, if you will, of Bruce Lee back in the 70s, the late 60s and 70s. And, you know, so martial arts films were all the rage. Kung Fu Theater was Saturdays, and I always watched Kung Fu Theater. So I watched all these martial arts films, and I'm seeing all these really cool weapons that they're using. So I see Bruce Lee and, you know, his amazing use of the nunchucks and you know, sticks that they use, the bow staff and taunts and things like that. So one of the movies that kind of stuck out to me the most in terms of kind of forming my urge to go out in Dad's workshop and make things was I want to say it was Enter the Ninja. It was a Golan Globus film starring Nero Franco as an American who studied ninjutsu and Sho Kosugi, who was, of course, the quintessential ninja of all things 80s. And at the beginning of the film, this character played by Sho Kosugi is demonstrating all of these weapons. And I saw sai and nunchucks and all of this stuff. I was like, oh, that is so awesome. So, you know, in my 15-year-old brain, I was like, I need some of those things. So my father had a workshop. My father always worked with wood craft. He would build furniture and stuff like that. In addition to, you know, being able to dismantle engines and put them back together in cars. So he had a very wide array of tools, and he still does actually. And the first thing I wanted to make was nunchucks. They seemed the most approachable and easily managed of the tools that I could make. So I went out to the shop and I found one of the, you know, just a dowel rod. It was probably a half inch, maybe 3/4 inch dowel rod. And I cut 2 12-inch lengths of it and I poked a hole in the top of each one and I screwed in an eyelet on each one and put a chain in between them. And voila, nunchucks, right? Wrapped the actual stick in copious amounts of electrical tape and went outside and started to tinker with them. So I don't know how many fat lips I ended up with because I hit myself in the face, hitting myself in the back of the head. So I kind of find it funny because I look at stores today and you're like, oh, get your foam nunchucks, right? Use your training nunchucks. I'm like, well, you pop yourself in the head with one of those things, you don't learn anything, right? So I'm using my nunchucks. I'm using wood that's wrapped in like 15 feet of electrical tape. And, you know, I bring it around the back under the arm. And because the chain's a little longer, it swings up and pow, hits me right in the mouth. And it's like, ouch, okay, don't do that anymore. And then, of course, you know, 10 minutes later, I proceed to do it again on the other side. So now I walk back in and my lower lip looks like I've been in a fight. So that was the first weapon. I, you know, probably messed with those things for, I don't know, probably 5, 6, 8 months. Just a long time just tinkering around with those. And then I was like, tonfa, we'll make tonfa next. 2 pieces of wood, smack them together, got it, no problem. So I went out in the workshop and I found a couple of pieces of, a piece of 2x2. And I measured the length of my arm and cut out a length that seemed about right. For each arm and took another 3/4 inch dowel rod and glued it and screwed it to the end of the, you know, about 3 inches from the end of the 2x2 and glued it on there and just basically, you know, put some stain on it and made them look nice and proceeded to use those. I wasn't very good with them. I didn't know what the world I was doing, but I tried. I picked up a stick out in the forest and that was my cane. I still have that stick, by the way. It's actually in the closet right over here, here at the house. I've kept that thing for nigh on 40 years now. And let's see. Oh, a staff. I simply fashioned out of a mop handle. That was the easiest thing to do.
Right. Right.
And I worked all these things in my backyard.
40 years, you have this with you now, a piece of wood, all right? And impact, you know, that's obviously, if anybody had seen you work out,
some of your dojo mates, even your family. When you use the weapons in your practice, as you said, you learned the hard way because that's how we learned, okay?
Right.
But now, when you practice and you get into your routine, what are some of the things you can tell the loyal listeners about, to be careful? In other words, you already told us chain was a little long. You put it under the arm, bang, you got smacked in the lip.
Yep.
Said, well, I won't do that again until you got to the other side. So what are some of the tips you can tell us since you've been around these weapons? When you're handling weapons, what are some of the things you tell the students, hey, be careful in that, watch them?
And I still tell students this to say, even without weapons, even an empty hand, one of the things about martial arts is that, again, if you watch too much television, if you see too many movies, stuff like that, everyone wants to go fast. It's like speed. It's like martial arts are fast. They hit fast, and that's, their magic. And the honest truth about that is the best way to practice is slow. Like, when you start swinging a piece of wood on a chain around your body in like a figure eight configuration, if you try to do that too fast and you're not accustomed to the motion and where the hand is supposed to go, things are going to hurt. So after a few times of thinking that I was Bruce Lee, with those nunchucks, I kind of realized, okay, I'm not quite up to his standard. So I had to back off of speed, right? So now I start practicing movements more slowly. I can now kind of go, okay, where's the chain going to lead that stick when I go around my back, over my shoulder, if you will, or between the legs across my inner thigh or around the back of my neck. So mimicking what I'd seen on television, of course, and in the movies. So now I could actually get a feel for where things were going. The same is true of a 6-foot staff. You start swinging that thing around your body and, if you're not careful, it will come back and hit you. So when you start operating slowly, you can gauge out where things go. It's easier to go from slow and inaccurate to slow and accurate to medium speed and accurate to fast and accurate, right? What's really hard is to go from fast and inaccurate to fast and accurate, right? So we have, of course, the modes of execution, right? Accuracy, fluidity, speed, power, tempo, right? So notice that speed is down that list. Accuracy is first. So accuracy comes at a premium. Accuracy cannot be marshaled by going quickly. It is a slow and steady thing that leads you to the accuracy, fluidity. Now you can move nicely in your accuracy, and then the speed comes after that. I was talking to some students on Friday night last week, as a matter of fact. We were working some Kihon, and these are new white belts who have been in the dojo for all of 4 weeks probably, and we're still working on our Kihon. Well, I don't want to teach them how to do Kihon fast. They're white belts. So the same is true from the weapons that we take into our, our Kihon training in the dojo, and that is go slowly. So we're going to make sure that when we throw that reverse punch to the solar plexus and then do the infantry retraction, that we are making center line accuracy a point, and then we're making the decent retraction back to the appropriate location. So nothing has changed in 40 years of training from what I learned when I was a teenager to what I train and teach today. That is, your speed will come, but you shouldn't try to push the speed to happen.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that with us, Vente, because everybody picks it up and wants to, like you said, look like, and that's how people get hurt. So starting slow, you described it so well that, starting slow and being inaccurate, starting slow and starting to get a little more accurate, It just helps with the building blocks and all of the little components that have to go into you building speed over time. Great advice,
exactly,
Sensei.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Now you mentioned something else about, I want to talk a little bit about Sensei Cunningham.
Sure.
When you met Sensei and you're now going to bring your kid to the dojo and see maybe we can get him to burn off some steam, how did you actually meet Sensei? Did you you just looked him up or somebody told you about him? How did you meet Sensei?
Okay, well, there are two parts to this story about meeting Sensei. The first one is pre-karate, and then the second one is when we actually took Silas to start training. Before I ever met Sensei, it was probably about, I don't know, maybe 6 to 12 months before we actually took Silas in to start training. So at the time, I was driving a very old Mitsubishi Galant, if I remember correctly, and it had a front end issue, something, I don't know, I don't do cars, but Sensei does. Sensei is a mechanic. And so right down the street from my house, maybe a mile away, is Sensei's place of business, Sensei's workplace. And I took my car down there, and I asked them to look at it because I was having this front end issue. And they said, well, you can go back there and talk to the mechanic. He'll let you know what you need to do. So I go back there. Unbeknownst to myself, this is Tim Cunningham, Kiyoshi, recently promoted to 7th Dan in Ishinryu Karate, owner of Cunningham's Ishinryu, soon to be inducted member of the Ishinryu Hall of Fame. So this is this guy that I'm looking at. I had no idea, of course. To me, he's just this, you know, 50-something guy who is working on my car, right? The first thing I notice about him, you know, besides, you know, his physical features, of course, is the fact that on his right hand, he has no fingers, right? Because he shook my hand, and I'm like, okay, this is new. So shook his hands, recognized the no fingers thing, talked to him. Correction. He talked to me for about, you know, 10 minutes about how to fix my car. Well, I am not mechanically. I can change oil and I can change a tire. I can do basics, right? So I talked to the man. He talked to me, rather, for about 10 or 15 minutes about how to fix my car and all the tools. And I was just like, please, can you fix my car or not? In my head, I'm going, I just need to know if you can fix my car, right? So I was just thinking, you know, this crazy old man is talking to me about stuff I know nothing about as if I know everything about it, right? So that was my first impression of Sensei. Not knowing who he was, not knowing what he was capable of, because having seen videos of him from years prior to me meeting him, I had no idea who I was talking to in that moment. Fast forward 6 or 12 months or however long it was, and we want to sign Silas up. So we now I looked up the dojo sometime previously. Sensei had a dojo at that time. It was in the back of the mall here in Tarboro, and it was a smaller site, and I'd driven around there and seen the dojo and the sign and all that, but there was no one there, so I couldn't go in and talk. Well, we ended up waiting a bit more time, and since they had relocated in that time from the back of this mall to a little shopping strip that's literally just across the parking lot from the mall, and a much bigger space in this shopping strip. So again, Alice and I talked about getting Silas into karate, and so we drove him over there, and having seen, you know, because it's literally right down the sidewalk from a McDonald's. So our kids love some McDonald's, at least when they were kids. So we saw the dojo there, and we knew where it was. So just this one day, we decided to show up and talk to Sensei. And we walked in, and, you know, he walked over to us as we came in, and the first thing I realized is when he shook my hand, it was that same no fingers handshake that I got at the mechanic shop. And I was like, you're the guy from down the street. He goes, yes. I said, we talked some time ago, blah, blah, blah. So we connected right there. So, you know, my first impression of him was that he was this very talkative, you know, mechanic who was working on my car. My first impression of him as this martial artist was Tim Cunningham, who came across the floor and greeted us personally and talked to us specifically about training our son.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. See, I didn't know that. I had no clue that that's how you met Sensei.
Yep.
And it's very interesting because, again, here you are trying to get your car fixed. And you described it beautifully where the man you're talking to is, you know, Cunningham Sensei. Now, I understand you didn't know that. But when you found out, now when you bring your son and actually put two and two together, well, wait a minute now, that's the mechanic that I brought my car to. Extraordinary. All right, now, let's ask this question. You've been with Sensei, you know, a long time now. What impact has Sensei had on you and your training, on your life?
Oh, wow. That's almost an immeasurable question. You know, you have very few people in the world, I'm afraid, have the luxury of having someone who is a mentor. You know, some people find that in their parents. Some people find that in people that they've gone to school with or grown up with, things like that. But a true, like, mentor who has literally your best interest in life in mind. And, you know, I came into the dojo fairly confident in my capacity in martial arts. He has taught me far more than I ever knew I could ever learn. And it's always nice to recognize that he has a lot more to give and I have a lot more to learn. But taking me out of the equation for just a minute, I've got to actually acknowledge what he's done for my family, because they probably have a much more measurable, if you will, growth pattern that happened through Sensei's tutelage and teaching and his constant giving. I'll take my older son, for example. When Daniel was a young teenager, 13, 14 years old, he had horrible, horrible, almost paralyzing social anxiety. He signed up for baseball as a teenager, and if we weren't the first ones at practice to get him out of the car, if there were already people there, he wasn't getting out because the anxiety of going into a group of people was just not in his wheelhouse. And, you know, we took Daniel to the dojo and we started training. From that point in time, he was 13 when we signed him up for karate. And before a year, maybe 18 months, that whatever that shell was that he used to protect himself, that shell of social anxiety completely fell away. Like, now we have this kid who is confident, he's ready, he's you know, excited about what he's doing, he's going out. And if you looked at Daniel now today, you know, he is 26 years old, he is a bodybuilder, he is a manager of a local gym, he is this bastion of health, and he's teaching others, you know, how to take care of their bodies, nutrition and supplement, all of this. So this kid went from 13 years old and terrified to be out in public to going through 5 years of the Army, jumping out of airplanes, going into Afghanistan, serving 9 months in the field, coming back home, and then, you know, carrying on a life outside of the military. Just that growth that he has shown is incredible. My wife, I can't even begin to quantify how he's helped change my wife. You know, Alice went from a, you know, kind of a quiet, demure, kind of background kind of person who would hold her tongue and not speak out a whole lot. And now she is this nationally recognized expert in outdoor sports, hunting, fishing, firearms, ammunition. She writes prolifically for a number of different publications. She is called upon for her opinions on a whole bunch of matters regarding things involved with the firearms and ammunition world. And I think that her growth in Ishinru has been a part of her growth in her personal interest in writing and all of those things. Both of my girls came through the dojo, and, you know, it's kind of hard out there sometimes for the young women in this world. You know, girls go to college, and they aren't wise and privy to the way that young men tend to think. Not all, mind you. There are some very fine young men out there, but some of those young men are predatory, and some of those poor young women aren't, you know, totally aware of that. We've managed to raise two young women who are extremely competent, extremely competent. You know, Hannah is, she's gone off and she's, you know, lived in the big city in a couple of different places, which is a far older move than I would ever choose to make in my life. She's lived in Chapel Hill when she went to school there. She lived in Washington, D.C. So big city life, you know, enthralled her for a while there. And then she decided maybe to settle back into some country living. So she's back here in Edgecombe County with us now. Then Emma is an absolute unit. I don't even know how to, like, qualify my younger daughter. She is the strongest Shodan I've ever seen come through that dojo in a lot of different ways. She is far better than I am, to tell you the truth. She is a very good, you know, her Jiukumite is outstanding. She has excellent groundwork. She hits like a train sparring this girl. I've been punched in the stomach by this girl in sparring Jiukumite. And, oh, Lord, just this, she has that penetration, that energy penetration. That is so amazing. And she's a bodybuilder, and she just graduated from high school, and she's getting ready to go off to college, where she'll train with T.D. Gribble Sensei at ECU, and I'm so envious and so jealous that she gets to go do that. And, you know, Silas, of course, he's now in the Army, and, oh, he is probably one of the best stand-up fighters in the dojo. All of that energy that he had when we started him has been channeled into his Ishinru, and now it's been channeled productively into his life. And I get to see, you know, this young man who was frustrating in a lot of different ways when he was growing up, who has grown into this, you know, incredible, you know, young man that he is now. You know, he's 20. Yeah, he's 20. Going to be 21 this year. I can't even believe that. So, and jumping out of airplanes and doing these amazing things for the service of our country. Just, you know, what Tim Cunningham brought to us was training and martial arts and Ishinru, but there was also that hidden element of the training, which is, you know, life experience, growth, confidence, the ability to manage conflict, the ability to look adversity in the face and stare it down. You know, it's when you stand in front of someone like, you know, Sensei Cunningham, I have to acknowledge, you know, Chris Duke, who was formative in our growth. He is one of Sensei's godans. He's Sensei's only godan, as a matter of fact. And just an absolute, you know, hero on the mat. When you stand in front of someone like, you know, Sensei Duke and realize that this sparring match is about to be him, the cat, toying with you, the mouse, you look adversity in the teeth and say, okay, you bear down and you go in and you do the work that you have to do in order to get through the experience. And over and over and over and over and over again, we've been subjected to that. It's, we would call, I guess, the dojo is a type of a crucible, you know, where you are heated and pounded and heated and pounded and heated and pounded until there's, you know, the opportunity to be tempered in all of that. And that's when the hardness happens. So Sensei has given us the training and the, you know, location to find that tempering. And we're all better off for it now.
I heard this. When there's an impact, Jace, it can't be measured. But the common denominator in your mind is that Sensei is giving of himself 100%. He is, and I love the way you describe this because it's very important as to why the chemistry is the way it is, and that he has your best interest at heart 100%. So you combine those two, and now you have this chemistry that produces this result that over time, you describe it as, I can't measure it because between my daughters, my wife, my Sensei Duke, all these people, I measure that because it goes so far, so wide. It when you talk about confidence, look at what happened to Daniel. And then to see the way because I was part of your promotion, and I got to see the way you interact with your family. As you said, you were punched in the stomach by your daughter more times than you can count.
Yeah.
So, well, no, look, Sensei, this I use the word on the marquee, extraordinary, because in order for you to go home now and be dad, you have to take off the martial arts hat now, and you got to put on
yep.
the dad hat, and now
yep.
you're home, you're not in the dojo no more. So this now, it promotes a behavior and a discipline that when you have to change hats, even at work, you have to change hats at work, got to have a different skill set, got to work with different people, so on and so forth. Everything changes, but you adapt it. As you said, when you're facing Sensei Duke, all right, this is about to go down now because this man is trying to give me some experience.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that experience comes with some lumps and bruises. What are you going to do? So,
exactly.
That discipline, Sensei, if now let me say this. With the chemistry that you've experienced here now, with Sensei Cunningham, your family, all these people, can you imagine now, Sensei, if there were more people like Sensei Cunningham around, look at the result you got on you and yours. So can
oh,
you imagine what the world would be like if we had more Tim Cunninghams? Okay?
Absolutely. Oh,
because,
boy. Wouldn't that be it? So the thing about Sensei Cunningham is that we have, and, you know, Hanshi Glover, who is Cunningham Sensei's instructor out of Burlington, Graham, actually. But Sensei Glover once described Sensei Cunningham, you know, in front of the class. He said, you're one of the most humble people. And he's not wrong at all. You know, Sensei Cunningham is very, he's not self-aggrandizing, which is a refreshing change in the martial arts world, where a lot of people are very, you know, out there, if you will. You know, Sensei is very quiet. He's very kind of, he doesn't talk about himself at all. He's peaceful. Despite the fact that he's a warrior, he's peaceful and doesn't seek conflict when conflict would actually, you know, knock on his door. He doesn't seek to engage in conflict because he knows, you know, you consider the Mizudami, I have the raised hand of, you know, of power. but the hand that's extended is the hand of peace. And that's sensei all the way around. He's always extending that hand of peace, knowing that in his back pocket he has, you know, this power that he can use. And sensei, if more people were like that, if more people had that understanding that, you know, you have incredible power physically, mentally, spiritually, but you exercise peace, humility, and things.
Yeah.
The world, if we had a million more of those, then the world would obviously be a far better place. And it's one of the most notable things about him. Even when he the website has kind of run its route. We have a video of sensei. I put a video up of sensei delivering his 2012 IHOF Ishinru Hall of Fame speech. And one of the most poignant statements that he made in that speech was that he is an artist, martial artist, obviously, but he's an artist on a lot of different levels. But sensei is an artist, and his students are his canvas. And that resonated with me incredibly. I teach public school. That's my career. And I've been doing that for 28 years. And that has absolutely reshaped the way that I approach my work at school, teaching high school English to 11th and 12th graders, that these students are my canvas. I'm just an artist who is, allowing the art to take place, if you will. And that's what how sensei described us. Oh, yeah, the world would be such a better place if we had many, many, many more Tim Cunninghams running around the landscape.
I can hear it. I can hear it in your voice. I can hear the way you describe him, the reverence, the respect, the impact he's had, the outcome. Some people do things and the outcome is not what you want. I have to agree where he's the artist. You're the canvas. And all he's doing is being a part of what you need. What do you need? As you said, when you started, you brought your son to take lessons. So what do you need? Okay, the kid needs to burn off some energy. Bring him here, and we'll make him tired. No problem. So very accommodating, very understanding. Now, let me ask you this, sensei, because, again, impact. Now, since you can't measure it, that it's immeasurable to you, and it's so sincere, I can't measure it. I mean, when it comes to me, comes to my family, it's very hard to describe, okay? But now, since you've been around the dojo, let's talk about some of the others that you've seen now that have taken this architecture from sensei and applied it, and it's working for them. Some little kids, you got any little kids maybe that, you might want to talk about, that, oh, sensei did this, Any examples like that as well?
So let me see if I got your question correct here. So taking that same impact and imparting it to others, is that what we're looking for?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Things that you've seen now, because you've been there and you work out, sensei's mm-hmm. on deck, and he must interact with others as well. And, again, you've seen it now with your children. You've seen it with your family. You've seen it with the other students. But how about now, let's pick out now a little child that maybe came to sensei and needed something.
Mm-hmm. So small children are not my forte. However, Alice sensei is really good with these small children. I can talk about her in a moment. I do really well with the say preteens, teenagers, because those are the ones I've been working with for the past 28 years as a school teacher. But it's kind of all the same, young person of whatever age, comes into the dojo, they're frightened, they're nervous, they're possibly just like I was. They're bullied, they're, you know, afraid to go to school, things like that. And, you know, they come into the dojo and, you know, the first thing you want to greet them with is this, you know, smiling face. Is one of the things that we got from Sensei the first time we ever walked through the door, was a friendly face who greeted us and talked with us and wanted to know our situation and what we wanted from this whole karate thing. And, you know, so now I have these kids coming in the dojo, and, you know, when they're preteens and teenagers, a lot of times it's a decision that they've made themselves that I want to take karate. Alice gets these children at 4, 5, and 6 years old. And these are the ones who the parents are like, help me with this, the same way that we were with Silas when we first walked through the door, right? We're like, help me with this. So the child has too much energy, or the child has anger management issues, or, you know, insert problem here. And Alice is able to do the same thing. She teaches that that warm, friendly, and accepting person, while at the same time, there's discipline. There's the structure, the repetition, and the, you know, the learning that happens in that 4, 5, and 6 year old class. Then Alice goes and she helps with the other youth classes on Tuesday and Thursday night. So Alice is in the dojo conceivably, four nights a week routinely. She's in the dojo teaching four nights a week. And then of course she trains, you know, in the adult class, a couple more times a week. So she's spending hours and hours and hours on the mat. And a lot of that time, as instructors in the dojo, it's our job. It's incumbent upon us to, Sensei has given to us. It is our responsibility. It is our calling, having received from Sensei, to give that to give what Sensei gave us to others. And we teach in the best way that we can. And, you know, we've seen Sensei model his teaching, and we try to model our instruction after what Sensei does. So we love, like, I'm going to use an example of one of our Yudanshas. His name is Vadim. Vadim came to the dojo, 10 years ago, maybe longer than that. It's been quite some time since Vadim has been a member of our dojo. And he was this little tiny fellow for years. I swear the kid never grew more than a few inches over the course of 6 or 7 years. He was always this tiny little kid. And I, you know, watched him graduate from high school, because he went to the high school where I teach. He graduated from high school just last week. And now I see this bold, confident kid who's getting ready to go to East Carolina University and get his degree in cyber technology. And, you know, it's really cool to know that, you know, in a couple of different places, both at school and in the dojo, I was able to help bring this kid along. And he still comes to the dojo. He still trains 2 or 3 nights a week. He drives from 45 minutes away into town and trains with us. And there are several of our young people who started training years and years and years ago, who are still there, and we're still teaching, and we're still helping to form. Alice has a pair of twins that she helps on Tuesday and Thursday nights. Matthew and Mason are their names, and they started with Alice when they were 4 or 5, and now they're, I think, 12, 11 or 12 years old, and they're still training with Sensei. They still come dressed exactly the same, and it's so fun to see that, you know, these kids are coming and they're getting the lessons, and they're getting the growth, and they're getting the all of the other kind of under the current lessons that, you know, that Sensei teaches, and, you know, Sensei Alice teaches, of course. It's been a remarkable journey. The teaching obviously is far more impactful, honestly, than some of the instruction that we get directly, because young people stretch you. I mean, they ask you questions. They're like, let me ask about that. They actually cause you to analyze your own practice so minutely. It's It's amazing. I learn so much from the young people when I teach them, and I hope that they learn as much as from me as I'm learning from them.
They do, Sensei. They do. Now, you said something before I want to touch on about your wife, Ella Sensei.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that during her study that she evolved in a way that, again, was very productive, very positive, very sure, very well thought out. Being a mom, going to dojo, doing the things that she's involved in, very busy schedule, Sensei. So let's give a little bit of time talking about Ella Sensei, because, again, impact. You know, she has a wonderful impact on these people that she's working with, especially the young ones. Mm-hmm. So let's just go back to that turning point that you mentioned about when she started to take the lessons, after watching your son Silas do it. You know, she sort of leaned over to you, especially after watching. Something sparked in her that she wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, being a mom is a full-time job, all right?
Oh, absolutely.
No question, all right? So that's overwhelming in itself because it's 24/7. It never stops
right.
Being a mom.
Right.
It never stops. Even when they're sleeping, they still have to, you know, they're still responsible. So when you get to a point now where you see your wife sort of blossoming now, and again, when I asked before about impact with Sensei, you said, well, I can't measure it because it goes so far and wide that it's hard to quantify, all right? So now you're watching your wife now go through this process and this transition, being confident, because you mentioned that word a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
How does that make you feel, Sensei?
Oh, wow. I would consider myself my wife's biggest cheerleader. I mean, I am so immeasurably proud of who she's become. Honestly, when we started dating, this is a woman who wouldn't even pick up a phone to order a pizza. So, you know, we've been together for quite some time, but, you know, 35 years ago or more, you know, she couldn't even, or 30 years ago, she couldn't even, you know, pick up the phone and order a pizza. And, you know, when we were sitting there watching Silas train for those months that he was out there and we weren't, what was going on in her head was this concept that she's watching Sensei do this work and, you know, teaching these kids. And what she found was such sort of elegance in what Sensei is doing, you know, in the movement, in the kata, in, you know, all of the things that she was observing. So I think she was first drawn to the aesthetic of karate, that it was a beautiful thing to behold. And she kind of wanted to learn how to do that. And of course it's morphed over time to where she still embraces the aesthetic of karate, but she's also, you know, far more cerebral and looking into, you know, her place as a woman in a typically male dominated area. Again, she, you know, writes about ammunition and firearms and hunting and fishing. So she's not unaccustomed to being a woman in a male dominated area. I think, however, her growth in the dojo kind of helped form this current track that she's on in terms of her life trajectory. Gosh, I mean, like I said, I can't be more proud of who my wife is and who she's become and how she's grown over the years in training in the dojo and then, of course, taking the life path that she is now with writing and being, you know, prominent, you know, figure in the world that she's in. So it makes me feel proud, but of course it makes me feel, you know, humble. you know, I went into the dojo with already several years of martial arts experience behind me. So I had, you know, a foundation going in that my family and everyone else didn't have going in. So to watch her come from someone who had literally probably never thrown a punch in her life, never thrown a kick in her life, to, you know, testing for Yandan just a few weeks ago, and, you know, seeing who she was out there on that mat, and, you know, embracing the struggle that was her Yandan test. And, you know, God, I mean, I have literally wept tears of pride over my wife and, of course, my children. I mean, I don't know how many times I've lost it because I was so proud of my kids. But my wife, too, she's an amazing human being. She's an amazing martial artist. She's an amazing woman. She's an amazing partner. You know, gosh, I'm so, you know, like most men, I married up, and I'm definitely blessed to call her my wife.
You know, listen, I'll say this again. I hear the sincerity in your voice, that wholesomeness. All of this contribution, all this work that's going on here, what I see as a common denominator is bringing everybody together. Everybody's learning how to work together. Whenever there's a question that comes up, we have all of these people that we can pull some answers from because we trust them in the dojo. Alice Sensei is like a mom figure anyway, teaching these kids. So they must be very receptive to her because she has that kind of personality, very approachable. You're not afraid to ask her a question. I see this wonderful wholesomeness coming from this architecture. And it all stems back from what you said. Sensei has your best interest at heart, 100%. And that he's a good listener. That's another thing I'm getting from you. Sensei's a good listener. And then he's willing to do whatever it takes to help you achieve what you came in for, whether it's to get your car fixed or to burn some steam off for your kid.
Right, so yes.
That versatility spans across his work, you know, his daily professional life, obviously. And then when he goes and he takes that hat off now and he goes in the dojo, he comes with this profound architecture that breeds wholesomeness, respect, work ethic, honesty, all these wholesome qualities, Sensei. So now again, you're a school teacher. Knowing that these course of events that happen in our country, parents now grieving, all this horrible stuff, if they could only employ Sensei's architecture, all that would be fixed. And it's so simple. It's such a simple thing. But yet people would resist because they're stubborn or they don't know this, they don't know that, ignorance, whatever. So, again, this has to be noted that this architecture, that Sensei sort of, you know, as you said, he's the artist, you're the canvas, and he's just being an artist. Sincere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
right.
Sincere. So, all right, so let's shift gears a second now. Because I know since you said when you started you really liked the weapons, in our practice, we have some bokata, or we have some saikata, we have tampakata.
Uh-huh.
What are some of the things that you really, really like about practicing weapons? Let's start with the bow. What do you really like about the bow?
The one of the greatest things about the bow. So, you know, you have weapons, you know, we have to consider them, you know, of course, an extension of our own bodies, and that we can accomplish with our empty hands with our kata, the same thing that we can accomplish with the weapon in our hand, our kobudo. However, one thing about the bow that is especially exciting for me. I love the kata, first of all. Shishinokun is a beautiful thing to behold. I love Shishinokun kata. However, the thing about a weapon that makes it useful, practical, and applicable in your daily walk, if you will. So I live karate daily, and if I were in a situation where I needed a very quick and accessible weapon, it is the easiest thing in the world a lot of the time in most occupied spaces to find something that is bow-like. You can find a broom, you can find a mop, you can find a shovel, a garden hoe. There are a lot of things that have that long stick-like proportion that you can use as a defensive tool outside the dojo. We train with a bow inside the dojo. Perfect. Well, if I'm in a restaurant and I've got to deal with, as you were just mentioning, the kind of current that's flowing through our country right now with these active shooters, someone coming into a restaurant and they have a weapon, and if I am far enough away that I need it, I can get a broom, a mop handle. It's a very versatile weapon in that you can access it anywhere in most cases, as long as it's an occupied space. And it translates very easily from dojo to outside the dojo. It's one of my favorite things about the stick and like a hanbo and the bow staff. So that's what I love about bow. Besides the kata are amazing. I love all three of them that we have in the Ishinu curricula. When I practice here at the house, as a matter of fact, I have a 6-foot bow, and I can use that here. I can go out in the yard and train, but if the weather's not conducive to it, I live in the middle of town, and I live on a corner, so people are driving by my house all the time, and I can be the weird guy out in the yard doing karate, which is fine. I don't mind that. I've done it for years. However, sometimes I can't go outside, so I have a mop handle in the closet in the back room, and that is my practice bow for when I'm practicing kata here in the house. It's 4 feet long. It's one of those that screws into the mop head. So I just unscrew it from the mop head, carry it out here into my open living room space, and boom, I can work Shishinokun, Urashi Bo, Tokuminokun. I can do those things. I can work Bo Sai Kumite, Bo Fighting Drill. I can do all of them right here in my living room. It's very manageable, and it helps me prepare for needing something of the sort outside of this house. So there's the bow.
All right, now let's just stay on the bow 1 second, because I want to ask this question. When you teach it, what are some of the pointers you give, basic pointers now, that you give to a student first picking up the bow?
So we break it down, obviously. Okay, this is how you hold it, at least in the Ishinru style. We hold our bow thusly. So I get their hands kind of measured out in the right place. We show them how to line themselves up in a basic ready stance. So what's kind of more, I think, eye-opening for the young people, new people who are learning bow, things of the sort. So get them, your hands are at here and here. You've divided the bow into thirds, and your hand is 2 feet from that end, 2 feet from this end, and there are 2 feet in between. You put your anchor hand here at your obi, and your other hand is out here in front of you, and then I take the bow away from you. Keep your hands there. I take the bow away from you. See where your hands are right now. So they have one hand down by their obi. They have their other hand out in front of them in like a guard position. I say, does this look like a fighting position to you? And the answer is always yes. Exactly. The only thing we are doing from going from karate to kobudo is we are taking an object and putting it in your hands, and it has now become an extension of your body, not an accessory to your karate, right? It's not an we're not accessorizing here. We are simply adding an extension. That punch that I can throw with that backhand now has a length that is about 4 feet longer, maybe 5 feet longer than it is when I have it. So when I throw that punch, boom, I can now reach out and touch someone from across, you know, a much wider space as opposed to having to be, you know, within arm's reach of that person. So it's that understanding that we are not changing anything from here to here, from empty hand to weapon. We're simply enhancing distance and maintaining the same form that that we use with our empty hand. You know, a down block is a down block, even if you're holding a bow. A down block is still that down block. The middle block, J-hook kind of block, is still a middle block. It's not changing a whole lot just because you have a piece of wood in your hand. So that's kind of where I start them, how to hold it, how to, you know, set their feet, get a good, you know, dutch to utilize that weapon effectively. We want to teach them, you know, proper movement and throwing those, you know, the first punches that they'll ever throw. You know, so again, everything is slow and steady. We're going to walk you through it. And then we'll start teaching some of our kihon, if you will. A lot of our kihon comes through our bow fighting drill. And, you know, our students get a chance to actually work some of the manipulation of the bow and moving it here and here, side blocks, high blocks, low blocks, with a bow as a part of the bow fighting drill that Sensei teaches in his dojo. So I do very much enjoy teaching bow.
Well, I heard you say that some of the stuff that you've learned from Sensei, you've applied to your professional life. So same thing applies now. You are teaching skill sets to people that are in the dojo, obviously have been brought along far enough that Sensei allows them to learn this material, making it safe for them. As you said, everything starts very slow. Let's make sure you have your stance right. Let's make sure that you are handling this extension properly, distance and timing now. What I'm getting out of this is that if you live in the Tarboro area and you have children or looking to get in shape, you have to look up this dojo, because look at what's going on here. Not only do we have, you know, one of the most revered senseis in our practice teaching at this dojo, but look at the quality of instruction, folks. You have a family working with all the students. One of them is a school teacher, so he works with children every day, so he knows how to behave around children. All of these things contribute to the outcome. If I send my kid to this school, what's going to be the outcome? Rewind this program. You'll hear Sensei describe in detail how it has affected not only him, his family, all the others that participate at the dojo, and then all of the people that interact with that dojo family. See, because that's the thing about impact. Impact has a profound way of permeating through your everyday life, of people that you interact with, people that you are friends with, relatives, mom and dad, grandpa and grandpa. All of these things contribute to an outcome. And that's what you want. You're especially in today's pressure. Let me call it pressure, because everybody's under a lot of pressure. When that pressure exists, one of the things you do need to do is relieve the pressure. Otherwise, the pot will blow up. So when you go to an offering like this, because that's what I'm going to call it, an offering. Yes, it is Ishinu Karate Do, You do learn the weapons. You do learn the entire syllabus. And the curriculum is taught to you in such a way that's understandable. We get that part. But that's why you went there. It's a karate school. But I love what Sensei said about the stuff that happens that you wouldn't think happens in a karate school, such as a little child learning. When Sensei says, okay, get in Seishan stance and stand this way, and the child does it, behavior is profound because, first of all, trying to keep the attention span of a child probably lasts about 5 seconds, and they're onto something else. So in order for you to interest them in such a way that they'll stand in their stance and they'll do what they're told, that's what we need. We need more of that. So having said that, my next question now is about the size. What's one of your favorite things that you do with the sai? Is it blocking? Is it striking? Is it handling? What interests you about the sai?
Okay, so throwing back to that opening scene of Enter the Ninja back in 1980, whatever, Shokosugi doing his sai work at the beginning of that, and I was always like, oh, that's such a cool weapon. Completely unreachable and unapproachable by me at that time because obviously it was not something I could make in Dad's garage. But, when I finally had a chance, now I had this – I worked in the dojo for – I mean, I was training in the dojo for several years before I ever put my hands on a pair of sai. But I saw them on the wall, and I was like, soon I would get a chance to work this. And I finally got a chance to pick up the sai, and I had two really fantastic people help me work sai. Now, Sensei, of course, was my primary mentor. I had two other people, though, who I distinctly remember working with me on sai. One of them is Sensei Liberty Break. She was one of Sensei's very early students here in Tarboro. She was promoted. She was the first woman in Sensei's dojo promoted to Sandan. She's an amazing, amazing martial artist. She is an amazing karate brain. And I got to work with her on sai. She was the one who taught me how to use the sai, initial movement with the sai. And it was all just fascinating to me because I absolutely adored the weapon as a teenager. And now here I am, so 40-something-year-old man, finally getting the opportunity to train with these weapons. And Sensei Liberty, who is a technician when it comes to kata. So I was probably a blue belt, I would think, that when I first started using sai, maybe a purple belt, I don't recall. But I first started training sai, and I was learning kusanku sai, and I got the movement of the kata, the movement of the weapon itself kind of worked through, and it was really exciting. And then as I trained more and more with the weapon, I was learning the kata and preparing the kata for, its proficiency and obviously in testing and stuff like that. And another of Sensei's Yodansha, his name is Jeremiah Filkins. I remember the lesson very distinctly. Jeremiah didn't train with us very often, but again, he was one of the old guard of Sensei's dojo from back in the day. And He had stopped in the train. He's a Nidan in Ishinru, and he taught me, refinement, if you will. I still pass this on to kids today, as a matter of fact, to new students who are learning sai. And he said, when you're opening and closing this weapon, imagine that you have a laser beam that's coming out of the tip, and you don't want that tip to cut. That laser beam will cut off any part of the body that it crosses. So you want to open your sai, close your sai in such a way that they're not coming toward your body, right? Safety first, obviously, things of the sort. And, he worked with me for that evening on just how to manipulate and move the sai from open to close, up, down, sai. So it was really just a fantastic training session. It was a one-time deal, but I remember it still because it was such a formative part of my use of the sai. So I guess when it all boils down to it, I had this, ethereal, idealized version of what the sai were. from seeing Shokasugi use them at the opening credits of this movie, and then finally being able to put my hands on them 25 years later and go, oh, it's like the precious is in my hand, you know. And I took it very seriously because I thought it was just a cool, I guess is the best word to use, a cool weapon. And it still is. I still love Kusakusai, Chatanyarusai, two fantastic katana. I love them both.
All right. I want to ask this question. We'll talk about the Tampa in a second, but I want to ask this question because we are getting close on time now. What is your take about our founder, Shimabuku Tatsuo Sensei? How would you I'm a brand new student, let's say, and I come to you and you say we have this founder, Shimabuku Tatsuo Sensei. How do you feel about him, Sensei Webb?
I've never been asked that question before. You have to give all deference and thanks to someone who did what he did in order to become the karateka that he became. His persistence in wanting to train with Kian Sensei and his diligence in learning Goju Ryu and Shorin Ryu and training those styles, and then, of course, in the 50s, developing the Isshin Ryu system. I mean, we walk in the footsteps of giants. And Soke Shimabuku Tatsuo was just, he was a giant in his own right. He was a trendsetter. He was teaching Americans, this martial art that he had developed. And, Japanese have a long, standing tradition of not really preferring that their martial secrets leave the island. And here is Soke, teaching these American GIs and Marines and these guys this, this martial art that he had developed. I've watched his videos and seen him work and heard the legends and the stories of, being able to climb up a light pole or a straight pole, just climb up barehanded and then turn around and head first, crawl back down, and his ability to just rip bark off of trees with his bare hands. And there's so many, legendary stories about Soke. But what he gave us, he passed Isshin Ryu on to these Marines, and then they brought it back to the United States. And thank goodness for Camp Lejeune here in North Carolina, where we had so much Isshin Ryu here, and then of course out in the California area. And having had Advincula Sensei come to North Carolina, and having had the opportunity to train with Advincula Sensei, and get literally firsthand, first person knowledge from someone who is so close to Soke. You realize the enormity of the Isshin Ryu world, and then at the same time, you're humbled by where you stand in it. At least I do. I'm humbled by where I stand. I like to say right now I'm a big fish in a very small pond, and then I go to IHOF and I look around and I'm like, I'm the Emily Dickinson. It's the English teacher coming out. The Emily Dickinson. I'm nobody. Who are you? I realize Soke's contribution to the Isshin Ryu that is here in obviously it's far more than contribution. It's the inception of Isshin Ryu here in the United States, and where it's come since. Where would we be without Shimabuku Tatsuo Soke? I mean, where would we be? What would we be doing? What would we be talking about? How different, it's one difference. I had a student write this. I said this kind of in passing in class in my English classroom last year in the fall. And one of my English 3 students, one of my American literature students, wrote it down on a post-it note and just left it on the table kind of inconspicuously. I don't think she really intended for me to find it. She just wrote it down because it hit her. And the thing that I said was one small change changes the whole story. One small change. If we didn't have Soke, if he didn't create a Shinru, if he didn't teach it to these Marines that he taught in Advincula Sensei and Don Nagel and all of these other Ishinru pioneers, I have to talk about Dan Glover, of course, Hanshi Glover, who is Sensei's instructor, my Sensei's instructor, Gunny Russell Best, Sensei. I mean, all of these people who learned directly from Tatsu Shimabuku and then brought it back here for us. If any one of those little pieces wasn't in place, the whole story would be different, right? We wouldn't be having this conversation. So, yes, all deference to Soke and, who he is and was and what he has done and is still doing for all of us.
What he is still doing. I love that because that's impact. The man has a profound impact on us. Every time we do anything that we do, whether it's a block, a kick, a step, I don't care what it is, we're doing what he wanted us to do. So that impact goes, I don't know how many generations now it's been since 1975 that he's been gone, but all these people now that have come, he's no longer here, but yet the children in your dojo are learning something that he created. I find that to be remarkable, number one. What a great focus it gives us some goals to set. And then, as you said before, you loved the sign, but you waited until you were a little bit older and you got a real technician teaching you now how to use it. That's extraordinary, Sensei, because that's a profound impact, okay? Now, how about this question about Soke Shimabuku Tatsuo? If I was to ask you, what is the message that Shimabuku Tatsuo Sensei is trying to give us here?
Another nice, deep question. If we consider the legacy that is Ishinru. That's Soke's legacy. That's his what he left behind for the world. He made a remarkable and impactful difference in a lot of people's lives. Again, he was a trendsetter in his own time, but in doing so, he left an incredible legacy. I think probably one of the things that, if Soke, I don't want to speak for Soke. I can't do that. I am not him, and I don't feign to know his mind. But I would hope that he would be celebrating that all of us are trying to do what he did and leave a positive full mark on the world. He left us in 1975, and as much as we try to avoid it, it's eventually going to befall every one of us that we too pass on to the next life, whatever that happens to be. And when we are at the end of this journey that we call life, we look back, what impact did we have? What did we leave behind for others to model or to follow or something of the sort? So I think leave a lasting legacy might be a message that he would embrace and celebrate as ongoing.
So what I sort of take away from that is the message of
persistence. Do your due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you practice. Learn our customs was one of the things he wanted to, you know, sort of get that message out there. Learn the Okinawans, and the Okinawans will learn the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep the continuity in the katas. Let's keep the continuity in the basics. They tell me, if you learn the basics, you have now the tools to learn the kata.
Right.
I teach my students that each kata is like an encyclopedia. It's a volume. You go into this book and you can extract all of these little gems that exist. I also tell my students that we are inherent jujitsuans because in our kata, we have a lot of jujitsu.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
The idea of that cross training, my sensei was big on learning as much as you can and applying it to common sense. That's basically what my sensei was all about.
Makes sense.
Keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, keep it simple. We have to learn and teach this curriculum and syllabus, but there is so much there that it's almost impossible to be good at everything. You have to teach it.
Right.
You have to know it. You have to be able to explain it. You have to be able to drill it. And you have to be able to apply it. However, I've gotten old now. I'm 63 now. I can't perform like I did when I was 20. So my karate has evolved. So I get that message from Soke Shimabuku as well. Evolution.
Right.
You're
sure.
Going to evolve. Where you started, where you are now, you've done some practice. That's good. Very good. That's healthy. You've learned some stuff. You've got better at some stuff. Oh, I see. Your instructor has allowed you to teach others. That's a good thing. So the message. I wanna bring to highlight now Sun Tzu Kata. Because this is the culmination now of the message in my mind. I see it as his explanation to me. You walk this Embusen, Daniel. Now, I never met this man, but I've been bowing to him for 45 years, and I never met him. But
all right.
You walk this, you walk this Embusen, Daniel, and you display this waza the way I teach, you know, the way I've taught, in my case, Don Nagel, and Don Nagel taught Ed McGrath, and then Ed McGrath taught me. So that's the path that it got to me. So now,
right,
you walk this path, this Embusen, and you do this waza. Practice it, learn it, fine-tune your skills within it, and then this message comes to me. And again, persistence. Do your due diligence. Practice. Learn the things that you're going to learn, the tools that you're going to need in your everyday life. Because when you go to work, if you display these qualities to your boss, he's going to give you more and more work because he trusts you.
Right.
My boss puts me in the field. He knows. I gave that job to Daniel. Daniel will finish the job, come back and ask for the next, you know, sign.
Right.
No problems, no hiccups. If anything happens, I call my project manager. I have a conversation, we take a direction, we seize. No problem. It's communication. So now, that word, he's communicating to me in my practice, inside of Sun Tzu Kata, all of these, I call them gems, sensei. To me, they're like gems. precious stones like rubies and diamonds, you know. They're precious.
Right.
And then, again, this communication going on with someone I never met. We're never in the presence, just like you. I watch the films. I see the way he displays his karate like it's nothing. Mm-hmm. Effortless, like I'm talking to you, okay?
Right, yeah.
So, as I said in your marquee tonight, that, you know, we're very excited to have such a well-practiced sensei speak with our loyal listeners, because on one tonight, if someone's listening in and they're hearing this conversation, the one thing they're going to come away with from this conversation is that there's a man in Tarboro who listens, he gives of himself, and he looks to accommodate whatever is in your life. What's happening? Tell me, and I'll work on it. And then he has a bunch of people helping him and, you know, nurturing. And so, again, I'll go back to Sun Tzu Kata, communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's talking. In that kata, I believe in my heart. Every time I think of that kata, every time I perform the kata, every time I practice the kata, every time I teach the kata, every time mm-hmm. I explain the movement of the kata, I feel as if I have to teach you all the other katas, the weapons katas, the empty hand. But when it comes to this one, we don't teach this kata until you're a brown belt in my dojo.
Right.
The way
same
my
here.
Sensei wanted it. Yes, the way my sensei wanted it. So in order for you to be a brown belt, you know what that is, sensei. You know what's required.
Right.
And then in your dojo, it's here's another word that comes to mind, organization. Sun Tzu, to me, is a very organized kata. I mean, the man took some thought. I don't know how he did it. I wasn't there. Advicula Sensei is, you know, a wonderful resource. And I made that comment, on May 30th. Everybody always posts something about Sensei. So I made that
right.
comment that I never met him, but that I was in the presence of Advicula Sensei. And to me, that would be the closest I could get to being in the presence of the founder, because that man, you know, I mean, he made our patch. He did everything, okay?
Right.
And then he posted a video the other day. I have to mention this. Him and his students are doing empty hand kusanku. And Sensei, it is so impressive. It is so well practiced. Sensei Advicula is doing the kata. And it's spot on, Sensei. He's fighting all these people, and it's so beautiful that it's inspiring. It's inspiring. I mean, when you show this to people, and now you're going to go practice this and try to get this the way he's got it. I mean, it takes a long time. You don't just snap your fingers and get this done. So,
right.
Again, inspiration is another word that comes to mind that he's trying to communicate to me, trying to inspire me. I mean, you know the kata. So in Sun Tzu kata,
right.
any piece of waza to another human being, we know the results, Sensei. We've been practicing it our whole life, basically. So that's another message. Confidence.
Right, right. Uh-huh.
Sun Tzu kata exudes confidence. So again, what is the message here? Ishinryu Karate. We have all these other karates on the island. What do we need Ishinryu for? Again, mm-hmm. that word persistent out. Because he was persistent. He wanted what he wanted. He wouldn't take no for an answer. As you said, he was very, very, I'll use the word tough. He was just a tough guy.
Right.
You would not be able to dominate this man. Steve Armstrong was, you know, three people bigger than he was, and yet since they put him on the knee. So it didn't matter.
Right.
I will say this. I don't know how you feel about this subject, but I have a love for this man. Deep in my heart, again, I never met him, about him with such reverence and, you know, this and that, but I've actually, over time, believe in my heart, I actually love this guy because of what he's done for me. How I received it, what it's done for others through me and my students. So I'm overwhelmed now. Now that I'm at the age that I'm at and I can sort of look at it from an experience point of view, because I actually experienced it, I actually have a love for this guy because I could only aspire to be like him. First of all, I'm not that smart to build a whole curriculum and, you know, the weapons and all this stuff. I'm not that smart. So,
right, yes, I understand.
You know, his level of intelligence and, you know, based on my level of intelligence, I already, as you said with your wife, you know, where, you know, you basically married, you know, up, you know.
Yeah.
That's the way I feel about him. You know, I saw it like he's up there, I'm over here. So, you know, I can only aspire to be like, you know. Again, very interesting conversation, Sensei. I really appreciate you taking the time, coming on the program, putting your heart on your sleeve, talking to the loyal listener base as a practitioner, an instructor, a dad, a mentor, someone you can ask a question to, and not feel that, oh, boy, if I ask Web Sensei that, he's going to think I'm an idiot, you know. No. It's quite the opposite, you know. You're a school teacher,
right.
So you answer questions all day, you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
It's part of your fiber now. I mean, you've been doing it professionally, what, 26 years, you said, so, you know.
28 years, yeah. It's hard to turn the teacher mode off. You know, I think you probably know what this is like as an instructor yourself, that you get into teacher mode and, you know, you're like, you just spent, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 minutes just talking about Sun Tzu, and that, again, you can hear the passion in your voice when you're talking about Soke. And, you know, that is, it's part of who you are. I've been a teacher professionally for 28 years. I was teaching kids when I was in high school, though. I mean, I've been a teacher practically all of my life. And, you know, you get into teaching mode and, you know, it's a little hard to switch that off. And I don't think I ever really do. But, you know what it's like. You teach, so you understand, I'm sure.
It's very gratifying when you can get from point A to point B. Set some goals, get into shape, meet those goals, and move on.
Right.
Very gratifying. A sense of accomplishment. The camaraderie. Let's work this out. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's figure it out. You having a problem
right.
with that?
Right.
Okay. You know, and it's again, you described it in your sensei. He gives of himself 100%. Whatever you need, he will focus on and give it his undivided attention with his heart, with his knowledge, with his experience, and that comes through loud and clear. Anyone who has ever met your sensei, anyone, from children, strangers, I don't care who they are, they all come away with the same common denominator. And we'll just sum it up and say the man's a gem. That's it. We need more Tim Cunningham in the world to help people understand you don't have to fight. You can learn how, but you don't have to fight. It's a choice you make.
Exactly.
And if you're disciplined enough, you don't have to fight. And that's a wonderful thing. That's another message that I get from
right.
Soke Shimabuka. So, all right, Sensei, we're at the close of our program. So I'll just lead in with this. Is there any question that I should have asked that I didn't ask?
I don't know. As I think about the conversation and reflect back on the last hour and some change, I don't know. You've done a very fine job of kind of bringing a lot of the most important elements of my experience and, you know, my training with Sensei and all that to the forefront, but also digging deep into some of the other stuff. So, no, I don't feel like we left anything out, sir. I think you've done a fine job here.
Again, then I have to say thank you for taking your time. I know your time is precious. You have a family. You work. So to spend a couple of hours with me, entertaining my loyal listeners, it's why they tune in, Sensei, because when you have a quality guest like this on the program, again, a common denominator of respect, work ethic, all of the things that you practice, all of the things that you teach, all of the things that you employ, it come out tonight because we're sincere about it. We love what we do. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. And then when you actually get to see the results, seeing results in strangers is one thing, but they become like family. But seeing results in your own family, come on, Sensei. Now, you got to give credit where credit is due because that work, once that work is done and the result has been produced, now you can sit down in the chair and think to yourself the impact that you've had on others, Sensei. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
So thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having
me. All right, folks,
enjoyed.
There you have it. Yes, yes, go ahead. So there you have it, folks, another edition of our program. We really appreciate you guys tuning in. There was callers on the switchboard tonight, people in the chat box, but I just didn't want to stop because it goes by fast. As you can see now, we're done. So again, Sensei, thank you. Give everybody a bow for me at the dojo and give Sensei a big hug for me, okay? Would you do that?
Absolutely. I believe he's listening in this evening, so I'm kind of held to it now. So, again, I just thank you for I thank you for asking me to join you and hosting me this evening. I've had a great time. Thank you.
Awesome. Keep punching and kicking.
Absolutely. Wouldn't stop.
All right. Good night, everybody. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. We're going to have Albert Mady Friday night at the Fights on the program. He's calling in from Canada. It's going to be a live broadcast. So tune in tomorrow night, same time, and the same number, 563-999-3090. Good night, everybody.
Hey, you.
out there.
Get out, get out.
Well, let's out.
Let's out.
Well, let's out.
Joe Vecino. God bless you, Joe. Bless you, my brother.
Down here in the river reach the sea, and in the heat I feel ya open up to me. My arms.